Hello everyone, welcome to Chan Podcast. Here is where you learn about meditation and Chan. So, what is Chan? Chan, spelled as C-H-A-N, is the Chinese school of Mahayana Buddhism and is the originating tradition of Japanese Zen. We encourage you to learn and practice meditation with a group. If you'd like to, feel free to visit our website londonchanmeditation.org.
Weather's changing. Okay. Everyone has a copy? Okay, this is the Heart Sutra, those of you who are new to the talk. This is the second of the series of talk on the Heart Sutra. Last time I provided a context for Buddhist practice, the basic Buddhist project, and some historical backgrounds about Chan. Also, towards the end, I briefly explained the topic of the sutra, the Prajnaparamita, Heart Sutra. So tonight we formally get into the text. Before we begin, would you like to join me to read this text together? The Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra. When the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was coursing in the deep Prajnaparamita, he perceived that all five skandhas are empty, thereby transcending all sufferings. Shariputra, form is not other than emptiness, and emptiness not other than form. Form is precisely emptiness, and emptiness precisely form. So also are sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. Shariputra, this voidness of all dharmas is not born, not destroyed, not impure, not pure, does not increase or decrease. In voidness there is no form and no sensation, perception, volition, or consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. There is no realm of the eye, all the way up to no realm of mental cognition. There is no ignorance, and there is no ending of ignorance, through to no aging and death, and no ending of aging and death. There is no suffering, no cause of suffering, no cessation of suffering, and no path. There is no wisdom or any attainment, with nothing to attain. Bodhisattvas relying on Prajnaparamita have no obstructions in their minds. Having no obstructions, there is no fear, and departing far from confusion and imagining, they reach ultimate nirvana. All past, present, and future Buddhas, relying on Prajnaparamita, attain Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Therefore know that Prajnaparamita is the great mantra of power, the great mantra of wisdom, the supreme mantra, the unequaled mantra, which is able to remove all sufferings. It is real and not false. Therefore recite the mantra of Prajnaparamita, Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisattva.
So, how many of you
have never read this before, please raise your hand. Just a very, very quick context of this text, and then we'll go into the text proper. The title, Prajna Paramita, Heart Sutra. Prajna means wisdom. It is something that we all have within. Yet it's covered by deluded thinking, our vexations, and different sorts of emotions, afflictive emotions. So it's important to uncover this wisdom that is intrinsic to us. And the process of uncovering is the paramita. Paramitas refer to, literally translated, it means transcending to the other side. The other side of what? The other side of liberation, right? And where we are is on this side of suffering, or different sorts of problems that we have, we face, different sufferings that we have. And the paramita consists of many different practices. Heart can be said that the whole of the Buddhist teaching, Chan teaching, Zen teaching, evolves around the single word, heart. Sometime the path is called by another name, Chan path. It's called the inner study, inner learning, because it's founded on the conviction that wisdom lies within, and the process of cultivation is to realize what lies within, realize our heart, our minds. Now, this heart is not the ordinary sense of heart, right? Like we know how we feel, we know where our hearts lie, but it's pointing to something that's without name, without form. What do you think this is? Without name, without form? Matthew? Will for compassion.
Bodhicitta.
Good. Bodhicitta means altruistic, the mind of awakening. That's the standard dictionary definition of heart. But what is this? What is this heart? Compassion and action, the will for compassion. Nathan, do you have an idea? Okay. Well, let's see if we can, by the end of the talk, we can discover, have some inkling of what this heart is. Okay. Sutra is a Sanskrit, Romanized Sanskrit word. It means scripture. And Buddhist text, the Buddhist canon consists of many, many different scriptures. And the Heart Sutra is probably one of the shortest texts. The shortest Buddhist text, Buddhist scripture, there are thousands. The shortest one consists of one syllable. I spoke about this last time. This is probably next to it. Sutra also has a different meaning. It means thread. Something that threads together things. So in this context, we can speak of the thread that ties together the wisdom, the transcendent wisdom. Paramita, practices that transcends from this side to the other side. So the thread that ties together the transcendent wisdom of the heart. So that's basically the title. So I will speak on this text from the perspective of Chan. And Chan, for those of you who are not have no knowledge of this, Chan is the one school of Buddhism developed around 7th to 8th century CE, and the spread to Korea, and then spread to Japan, and now it's most people know it by the Japanese pronunciation Zen. In Korea it's pronounced Song, right? So the Chinese word original word is Chan, and this Chan is part of a two-part Romanized Sanskrit word. It's called in Chinese is Channa, and it's the Sanskrit referring to the Sanskrit word Dhyana, which means meditative concentration. Right, so this school centers on the practice of meditation. There are many different schools of Buddhism, and some focus on kind of scholastic philosophical learning, and some focus on practice and different types of practices. So Chan focuses on a particular type of practice, meditation practice, not limited to seated meditation, but life as meditation. But seated meditation would be a foundation within Chan. So I speak from this angle. There are many ways to decode the Heart Sutra. It's very condensed, this text, obtuse. So the angle that I'm going to take is from the perspective of the Chan tradition, the tradition that I belong to. Now, what is this perspective, Chan perspective? The Chan perspective is the perspective of the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra has played a very important role, a central role in the development of Chan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism. It can be said to be the cornerstone. And the whole of this text, you see there's a lot of negations. Right? There's no wisdom, no suffering, no ignorance. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Right? So the purpose of negating, in fact, different systems of teachings in Buddhism, what the Heart Sutra is condensing, is to point to the fact that there is something inexhaustible, something unborn, something undying, that we can never use up, lies within us. There's something that does not perish. And that something is heart. Yet this heart is not kind of conceptualization, our thinking mind, our kind of feelings. Is something without name. without form. And the whole text is essentially an elaboration on this. The reason for negating all the Buddhist teachings, actually the Heart Sutra consists of all the major Buddhist teachings, but it negates it, is that what these teachings leave behind once we study them is a kind of trace. And they become objects of attachment. So the basic fundamental principle, perspective of Chan is that there's no need to attach to even the Buddhist teachings. Yeah. Because all of these teachings essentially are like temporary kind of toys. The babies are crying, they just kind of dangle this toy in front of them. The baby stops crying, you don't need a toy anymore. Right? So they're kind of expediencies, right? Devised to cure particular problems. If you're free from those problems, then you don't need them anymore. Yet, many people come to Buddhism, come to Zen practice, because they feel they need it. They need it to resolve certain difficulties in life. They feel a sense of lacking. They feel they're suffering. Even those that come to Buddhism or Zen practice for health reasons, they hear meditation is good. I don't care about that wisdom, you know, the meditation, the prostration, lighting incense, the ritual stuff. I'm just here for my health. Even those people, they feel that something is lacking. They're lacking health, or they want to get something, right? And when they practice, they gain some benefit, which gives them a sense of confidence and faith that, hey, this is working. You know, my mind is able to be stable, can live happier. And they really become interested in the teachings. And it's at that point that the teachings become dangerous. Right? Prior to practicing, they maybe chasing after all sorts of things, material things. Now after they gain benefit from meditation, they chase after dharmic thing, Buddhist things. And Buddhism is very good at, especially the scholastic schools of Buddhism, it's very good at detailing many different levels of practice, many different stages, many different antidotes to cure different kinds of sickness of the mind. Right? If you're angry, you can meditate on compassion, and here are the four states of compassion and meditation. If you are jealous, you can practice generosity, one of the first practices of a bodhisattva, an enlightened being. The paramitas, right? Prajna paramita, is generosity. Right? Many different kinds. The Buddhists talk about 84,000 different Dharma practices, each one catering to a particular type of issues that we have. And they can become great objects of fascination. Right. Endless amount of learning. Right. And they become, unfortunately, objects of attachment. Right? And many people, when they practice Buddhism, they start to use the teachings to judge themselves, and especially to judge other people. like a ruler, measuring stick. Many students in the past have commented that when they practice hard, then they see other people. One of the first things that they notice is that other people are not really practicing that hard. Right? They see this person with problems, and how come you're not doing this? They see themselves practicing very hard. Mm-hmm. They got the perfect posture and everything. And this can be quite a problem. I remember when I was young, I grew up in a Buddhist family. And my mom was a devout Buddhist. She used to get up around 5 o'clock in the morning, every morning. She would do her chanting, and she would, she has her whole set of her own paraphernalia. She got her own gong, she got her own sticks, she got bells, she got a wooden fish, she got her scriptures, and she would, every morning, the whole family have to listen to that. And after some time, we just don't hear it anymore. Early in the morning, chanting. And I remember one time, my friend stayed over. And all of a sudden, in the morning, they hear, gong. And my friend's like, what the hell is happening here? And I was like, oh, don't worry, it's just my mom chanting. She's beginning her chanting. And we will make a racket. She would chant for about an hour. We would make a racket in my room, can't sleep anymore, laughing. She would be chanting, and banging her wooden fish. Wooden fish is this thing. And Buddhist practitioners would use this to keep rhythm in the chanting. Right? For example, was coursing in the deep Ajnaparamita, things like that. And except they would do it in Chinese or other languages. And my mom was great. She had her own schedule. And whenever we would make too much noise, she would chant the scriptures and yell at us at the same time. The words of scolding us blended nicely into the scriptures that she chanted. She would say, "Don't you know I'm chanting? Be quiet!" Chanting like that. So that would be an incorrect way of practicing. But very often, Buddhist practitioners are like this though. They have their own set of regimens they practice. And they will use the standard from the scriptures, and they will start judging other people. Right? Which defeats the whole purpose of any Buddhist teachings. All the Buddhist teachings are is for to cure our own issues, our own vexations, emotional afflictions, problems. As soon as we start to use it on someone else, then it becomes poison. So, the whole perspective of Chan is to point to the most essential point of practice. And bypass all the different extraneous aspects of the Buddhist teachings. Okay. And that's like aiming at a target. We aim at a target with a bow and arrow. We aim it. We shoot from the very beginning of learning archery. We aim at a target. we don't engage in other aspects of kind of muscle building, kind of stretching or something else. We just aim directly at the target. Doesn't mean we're going to hit it right away, but at least the target is clear in sight. And that target is the nature of our mind, the nature of our heart. And the function of the heart, to understand the nature of the heart, the essence, and the function. Now, Buddhist teachings tell us that. The nature of mind, the nature of heart, is emptiness. It does not mean a kind of vacuity, a loneliness, some sort, kind of empty, meaninglessness. It's not that kind of emptiness. Emptiness here means relationships. For example, this piece of paper. This piece of paper is made out of many different conditions. Paper is made out of non-paper. Right? Tree, bark, factory, the sun, rain, soil, all of these conditions. How many of you have heard me speak of this analogy or heard it elsewhere? Please raise your hand. Okay. All right. Most of you did. So, all of these things coming together constituting the paper. When one condition changes, everything else changes. There's no paperness to paper. Paper is made out of everything that's not paper. If the sun was very strong during 1 year and the trees were cut down, made into the paper factory, then perhaps the paper will be brittle, or in mixing, grinding down tree bark, mixing it with water, maybe not enough water, then the paper come out more brittle. Right? So one condition changes, then the whole thing changes. That's emptiness. Right? It means that there's no paperness to paper. Same thing. What we believe to be our opinion, our feelings, our views, everything that we think is our heart, our mind, is made up of everything else. Yeah, very often, we claim it as our own. This is my opinion. This is my view. Right? My experience. Yes, your experience happens because it depends on everything else. Right? Just like you sitting here. The experience of sitting depends on everything. The person who built this building, everyone that comes to practice together. So, recognizing emptiness on a conceptual level means recognizing the relationship that we, in fact, are from moment to moment supported by everything else. Everyone, everything is interconnected. For that reason, in Buddhism, wisdom, this recognition of this nature of emptiness, this dynamic, interdependent, interrelational wisdom, recognizing that, is a simultaneous realization of compassion. Right? I exist because of everything else. I'm here because I'm supported by everyone else. A teacher, for example, cannot be called a teacher without students. Imagine we have Monday night sittings. Every first Monday of each month, no one shows up. I speak to the wooden fish. I speak to the gong. So you may think that a person with a strong sense of self, me, my opinion, my view, my experience, may think that I'm here to speak the Heart Sutra. That's why all of you came. Right? That would be a very arrogant view. And that would be a view that's not consistent with the nature of reality. Right? Nature of reality, the heart we speak of, is interrelated. So the speaker speaks on the Heart Sutra because there's an audience. There's an audience. We requested it. That's why we began this series in the first place. Right. So the speaker is merely one factor, one condition in the mix. And the teachings that you receive, the things that you find beneficial tonight or any other night, comes from your own merit, your own practice from the past, maybe past lives. And the conditions that have brought you here so that you can derive benefit, okay, a new way to look at things. Depends on everything else. So it's very precious. Right? So aiming at a target means to recognize emptiness. Recognizing emptiness means to recognize relationships. Right? And that is wisdom and compassion. Yet this is the conceptual level. Right? On a practice level, prajna, wisdom, is something that we all have. Something that's intrinsic to each and every one of us. And there's not a single thing you can do to attain it, to hold on to it, to kind of cultivate it, nourish it. You may be wondering, isn't practice all about cultivating and practicing so we can discover our wisdom? That's not what practice is. Zen practice is not about attaining wisdom. In fact, the whole Buddhist project, Buddhist practice, has nothing to do with enlightenment, awakening of wisdom, realizing this interdependent nature. Why is that?
It's inherent.
Yeah, it's inherent. Something could be practiced, cultivated, nourished, then it can probably be lost. Right? If it's something's produced by practice, then it will go through destruction. Right? The Heart Sutra tells us, no birth, no death, not born, not destroyed. Right? Very clearly. So what is practice then? Why the hell should we cross our legs like a pretzel, right, and sit? Anyone?
That's the function of a Buddha.
Okay. The function of the Buddha. Yeah.
Not to become, but like that's what you do.
This is just what the Buddha do.
Yeah.
Huh. That's good. That's a typical Zen answer. What about relating it to our lives? What do practice do? When you sit, I have a couple of people from the group came out to me, said that, you know, they're very happy. Ever since they start sitting, their life is more stable. They're happiest as they have ever been. So maybe practice, functional practice, is to make us happy. Functional practice to make us somehow complete. There's another purpose to practice. And all of you know this. Practice deals with the emotional instability, agitation of mind. In Buddhism we call it, in Zen we call it the three poisons: greed, hatred, ignorance. From these three spin off all different kinds of vexations. So practice actually deals with that. Practice entails cultivation. You do something, you refine it, you do it over and over again. Right? And so practice deals with being free from vexations, the emotional instability, the things that are covering our wisdom. But the wisdom itself is something complete. So when Zen practitioners target, aims at the target of the heart, the most essential aspect of practice, they practice with great conviction. They don't practice for here to gain something from outside. We are replete with wisdom. So they practice with a great conviction that we sit, because this is what Buddhas do. Buddhas here means awakened people. We sit with a great conviction that there's Buddha nature within. The nature of emptiness, the nature of interdependency, the nature of prajna. Great conviction. When we sit with great conviction, dignity, will we be bothered by wandering thoughts? How many of you have wandering thoughts when you sat before? Just raise your hand. Will we be, are you disturbed by wandering thoughts? Annoyed a little bit? Yeah, a little bit. So when you sit with great conviction, we learn not to be disturbed by wandering thoughts. Just bring it back to the method. But if you don't have this view that wisdom lies within, then practice becomes kind of dog chasing his tail. Wandering thoughts you want to get rid of. Blissful feelings you want to grasp. Then that becomes your ordinary way of life, grasping and rejecting. Right? And spiritual practice becomes the same thing as anything else that people chase. Before they practice, they chase after material wealth. Now they practice, they chase after experiences. Same thing. Spiritual materialism. And it's like a dog chasing his tail. Never ending. And wisdom will never arise. Never be able to recognize it. So the path, the aim is to recognize under all situations that this wisdom lies within, and this wisdom is precisely the interdependence of everything. No need to grasp something or get rid of something. We don't lack anything in between. Within. Knowledge and experiences must be accumulated. Worldly knowledge, school, work, job, you can acquire it. But you recognize that in your acquiring of these things, it's not your thing. Your acquiring of all of these depends on everything. So we're humbled by it. first four lines. When the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was coursing or practicing in the deep Prajnaparamita, he perceived that all five skandhas are empty, thereby transcending all sufferings. The whole Heart Sutra is compact in these four lines. The rest is a kind of elaboration. It's the most important part. There are several key terms we should understand. First one, Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is a person who aspires to becoming fully enlightened, to become a Buddha. That's what that means. Fully enlightened. At the same time, saving all living beings, helping them to be free from suffering. That's a Bodhisattva. So anyone who aspires to practice, to develop our full potential as human beings, to be awakened, to be free from suffering, at the same time help other people to be free, that is a Bodhisattva, and you are a Bodhisattva. So from the Chan perspective, when we read this, we're reading our own life, our own life story. So we, as Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, Avalokiteshvara is a name. In Chinese, it can be translated two ways. One is one who contemplates the name of Avalokiteshvara, one who hears, contemplates the sounds of the world. That's one. Another one is one who contemplates freedom, liberation. That's the name. Avalokiteshvara. It's a Romanized Sanskrit word. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism, in which Chan, Zen, Tibetan Buddhism belongs to Mahayana Buddhism, one main branch, plays a central role. Avalokiteshvara represents compassion in Buddhism. It's the embodiment of compassion. Manjusri is the embodiment of wisdom. So these two are arguably two most important bodhisattvas in the Buddhist tradition. But when we understand this in the intellectual way, then we won't be able to relate it to our own lives. If we understand ourselves as Bodhisattva, someone who aspires to perfect oneself and to help other people, then we ourselves are Avalokiteshvara. And we ourselves should clearly contemplate freedom, liberation. In Chinese, it's 自在. Literally translated, it means free, at ease. Right, this key word, 自在, freedom. One who contemplates it. It's very important that we understand this. Because from the Chan perspective, because we are intrinsically awakened, we have intrinsic wisdom that lies within us. Therefore, we are intrinsically free. Who is the one who binds us? There's a very famous Chan Gong'an story of enlightenment, involving the first lineage master in China, Bodhidharma, came to China, so Indian monk came to China spreading the teachings. He says he gave a series of teachings. When he first came, no one understood him, but because his teaching was so advanced, he just decided to wait. So he sat facing in front of a cliff inside of a cave for 9 years until practitioners are ripe in China. This is in the 5th-6th century in China. The conditions are ripe for his teachings. And sure enough, one day this monk, his name is Hui Ke. Now he's been a general before he became a monk. Extremely skilled at the art of killing. And he has developed so much guilt from all the people that he has killed, all the battle that he has won. He became a monk. And no matter what he did, what sutras that he chant, what practice that he did, he could not relinquish this dis-ease inside of him. And he had heard that from Central Asia, there was this Indian monk in China now, that he resides at this, in the back of this monastery. So Hui Ke went to him, begging for the teachings. But Bodhidharma was still sitting, did not move when anyone come. He's talking, Hui Ke, please, Master, I'm here. I traveled over 1,000 miles to come hear your teachings. Please teach me. No response. Bodhidharma still facing the cliff. And Hui Ke just thought, I must demonstrate my sincerity. So he just knelt outside, kneeling outside the cave for days, snowing out. And finally, Bodhidharma came out of meditation. 9 years. This is the legend, right? He turned around and says, what is it that you want? Right. Hui Ke says, I would like you to pacify my mind. He says, you're not ready for the teaching. Took out his dagger. Monks carried daggers, by the way, back then. It's one of the 18 things that objects that monks supposed to carry. Not a long sword, you know. This is in the, it dates back to the Buddhist time, the forest monk tradition, right? Because they practice in the woods, in the forest, they can get themselves in trouble, right? Different wild animals. And they use it to protect themselves, and they use it also to cut for food. But this Chinese monk, he didn't have a dagger, he had a sword. Okay, long sword. He took it out and cut off his arm, and took the arm, put it in front of Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma looked at that and said, okay, you're ready for the teaching. The Bodhidharma says, so you want me to pacify your mind? It's just this is just a myth, a legend. Anyway, so you don't have to think about what happened to his arm, is he keep on bleeding? Don't worry about the details. So Bodhidharma says, show me your mind and I'll pacify. So Hui Ke was at a loss. try to search for his mind inside out. It's like, I can't find mind. What is his mind? So he says, teacher, I cannot find my mind. And Bodhidharma says, I've pacified it then. And upon hearing that, Hui Ke, all of his years of guilt, practice, question, doubt that he has, suddenly just pacified. Thoroughly enlightened. The point of this story is that one who contemplates freedom must understand the mind, the workings of the mind. If you understand the workings of the mind, then you'll naturally be free. It's just like all the wandering thoughts that we have in sitting, when we sit. And we feel troubled, or annoyed, or at least a slight feeling of, I don't want this. I want bliss. I want concentration. I want focus. Who's binding you? Who's making you annoyed? Who's making you want this and not that? When you are angry, when you are sad, at that very moment, you have to remember the first line, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, one who contemplates freedom. What is it that binds you? In fact, all of our deluded thinking, wandering thoughts, naturally liberate themselves from one moment to the next. Moment to moment to moment to moment. You don't have to do anything about it. Imagine sitting here, wandering thoughts. Do you have to do something about it in order for it to change? No, it just liberates themselves. So spontaneously, we are intrinsically free sitting here. Moment to moment, our mind is free. If you think, I gotta get rid of wandering thoughts in order to attain this, then you're just deluding yourself. Dog chasing the tail. Thoughts liberate themselves by themselves. What kind of thoughts? All kinds of thoughts. Your angry thoughts. Your sad thoughts. Excitement, right? Your jealousy, all the so-called poisons of the mind that's harmful for our own health and for those around us, they liberate themselves spontaneously. That's the nature of mind, free. Yet, we tend to have a habit of holding on to these feelings. So even though we know now that our mind, the intrinsic nature of our mind is non-abiding, moment-to-moment freedom. But we hold on to them. Why? Because of habit tendencies. Almost like the way we're wired. You know, some people, they get depressed. Depressed people, they feel very satisfied in that kind of sheltered, depressed state, self-absorbed state. It's actually a very strong sense of self-attachment. Contrary to the nature of their mind, the intrinsic freedom that is themselves, they themselves hold that. And all of us have feel, to some extent, this. Like when we feel sad, you know, we cry, we feel alone, our friends want us to come out of the house and do something, and say, no, I want to be like this. I want to be here. I want to stay inside. It's kind of this self-absorbed way. And that comes from kind of habit, tendencies, the mechanism that drives us. Because for lifetime after lifetimes, we're being wired to attach to this and get rid of that. Why? Because we don't see the intrinsic freedom within. So it has become a second nature to us. And that's what practice deals with. Practice doesn't produce that intrinsic awakened nature within us. Practice deals with these kind of habit tendencies, vexations and so on. But one who contemplates wisdom, contemplates freedom, recognizes that. It's great confidence when we sit, recognize that intrinsic freedom within us. This view itself is helpful in our daily life. Right. Next time you get angry at someone, you say to yourself, you take out the role of Bodhidharma, you ask yourself, where is the anger? You try to find it. You can't find it. Then you free yourself. Next time you have wandering thoughts when you sit, they liberate themselves. The mind's nature is non-abiding, moment to moment freedom. So when the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was practicing deep Prajnaparamita, deep, as if there's something shadow, from the nature of the mind, our intrinsic nature, is there something deep or shallow? It says the text that he is contemplating deep Prajnaparamita, deep transcending wisdom. From the nature? No. Small enlightenment, medium-sized enlightenment, great enlightenment. It's like seeing the sky for the first time. Right? You can see it from a straw, very tiny little circle, but it's still the sky. You can see it from the bottom of a well. You see the sky for the first time. You can come out of the well, so you see the sky's infinite vastness. But the sky is still the same. You see? Sky is still the same. Same taste. It's like tasting water for the first time, spring water. You taste it, one drop, it's the same as taking a whole cup. Even though the essence is the same, but experience is different. What makes a person's enlightenment experience is not conceptual, like all of us now understands that wisdom is intrinsic to us, our mind is original free, you know, we're the one who's kind of wired in such a way that we hold on to this and we don't want that, and we like this, we don't like that. We understand that conceptually. But personal experience, this transformative experience, non-conceptual experience of this awakened mind, free from kind of the filtering of our self-grasping. That experience can be shallow and deep. But what makes it that way? Our own hindrances. Our own hindrances. Our own psychological makeup. Psychophysiological makeup. Our own years of kind of karma, created karma, that formats us into a certain way. Our habit tendencies. So are obstacles. Some people can be more obstructed, some people less. So the experience, corresponding experience, can be deep or shallow. Prajna, paramita, transcendent wisdom. From the perspective of wisdom, is there such thing as transcending? Is there such thing as the other side? I'm in the side of suffering, and I want to get to the other side of liberation. If there's still this idea of this shore versus that shore, suffering versus liberation, then that opposition is the very thing that binds us. No prajna would arise. No realization would occur. See? Only when a subject, an object, suddenly vanishes. When you break through the shell of this kind of constant going through life, this self-referentiality, as if you're the most important person in the whole world. Everything you experience, you see, hear, touch, think of, kind of refer back to this self, I think, I feel. When you break through this shell and realize this interdependence of everything, there's no subject here as opposed to object, all of you out there. And we're different. Right? When this shell is broken through, right, then that's the manifestation of prajna. Now, the next third line, he perceived that all five skandhas are empty. Five skandhas. Skandhas are Romanized Sanskrit word for heaps, clusters. It's the Buddhist way to diagnose what constitutes a human being. Instead of the body-mind division in the West here, the Buddhists talk about five things. Form, our material base. Sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. Right, first one, form, is the physiological aspect of a human being. The rest of the four are psychological. So it's this process of form, sensation, perception, volition, consciousness that constitutes a human being. And here, what is interesting is, it's detailing what constitutes a human being in terms of its process. Right? Sensation, we can only have pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. All sensations, feelings, can be falling under these three rubrics. Perception, further along in this process, is this moment-to-moment categorization, labeling, conceptualization of what we feel, of what is sensed, the sensation, the label of good, bad, like, dislike, right. Friend, foe. And on the basis of this, the next thing happens sequentially. Volition, which means action. On the basis of what we feel, what we sense through our eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, even mind faculty, we construct labels. On the basis of these labels, we react. So essentially, what Buddha is saying, that everything that we're reacting to is not actually how things actually are. We're actually reacting to our own construction of the world. Right? For example, someone says hi to you. You know, feel, why? Why do you say hi to me? What's wrong with you? Don't you see I'm busy? Someone says, the same person says hi to me another day. We feel, oh, hi, how are you doing? Same words, same person, but because over here changed, our own perception changed, then the whole experience is very different. For example, your experience, the world, waking up the wrong side of the bed versus having a good night's sleep, your whole mood changes. That colors everything that you experience. So what we experience in the world is our own construction. So the key thing here is change our perception. Do you see? Normally, our perception is based on this kind of I like, I don't like. It's the most fundamental way. But if you recognize prajna, at least even in a conceptual level, you can start to think that, okay, not necessarily my opinion is the best. Perhaps other people have more different opinions. You can start to see other perspectives on things, other angles, other takes. You're less rigid about, the self-referential project that we're constantly engaging. Once perception happens, however, it doesn't matter what kind, we engage in action. Action, volition, here it means karma. For karma to occur, karma, just so that we're all on the same page here, Buddhist karma means intended action. Right? Intended action. So all actions are colored by intentionality. This does not mean like the ordinary sense of the word intention. Right? It also means unintentional things that we do. But in the Buddhist sense, they're still considered intention. Why? Because the self-attachment is operative, the self-referential. From moment to moment, it's operative. Even when you change color, I mean, when you change your posture, right? Or when your legs hurt, or the flies around and you scratch it, intention there. Right? I don't want annoyance, I want pleasant. And after you scratch, you feel much better. All the little detail actions that we do. And on the basis of that, of our actions, volition, all of our actions are stored in the kind of moment-to-moment flow of our consciousness, of our mind. They leave imprints on the stream of our consciousness so that they shape us a certain way. So a person with certain type of action tend to be very jealous. Then responding to one situation, your response will be different than another person who is always generous. Why? Because the type of action that we engage in propels us and shapes our experience. So we perceive things a certain way. So that's consciousness. Right? And the Buddhist has a way of talking about it as a repository, kind of like a storehouse. All of your actions are kind of stored. So next time you experience something, it's like you kind of reaching down into this goodie, this bag. If most of the things you store in this bag is crap, then when you reach down, most likely you're going to grab crap. If most of the thing is good, then you reach down, probably 60% it's going to be good. So no one is kind of shaping your life except ourselves. So we're the one who are putting all these goodies in the bag. And when we respond to the world, what tend to come out is what kind of actions are we taking. And Bodhisattva here, he realized that all five skandhas, this mechanism, form, sensation, perception, volition, consciousness, right? This whole flow is empty. Why? Because it's dependent on everything else. All of these things are interdependent. The five skandhas, the five conditions, if one thing changes, everything changes. But we usually grasp onto these five aspects as ourselves. my body, my sensation, my feelings, my perception, my views, my world. As soon as that happens, then the suffering. But when you see the intrinsic freedom of these things, these five heaps, the dynamic aspects of them, that there's no seer in the midst of seeing, there's no hearer. Everything is just interconnected. What you see depends on everything else that you have learned. What you hear depends on what you have experienced before. Then you can see things freely, not necessarily from your perspective, narrow perspective, but start to see things from different angles. Be more open-minded about things, then you're more freer. So being empty of self-grasping, we become free. And that's why the fourth line, thereby transcending all suffering, and that is the key, to be free. How to be free from your suffering? The degree of our suffering depends on the degree of our perception, the type of our perception. I can sit here in a pretzel shape for hours and I can feel happy. But if you want someone that don't want to sit in a pretzel shape, you force that person to sit for hours, it's going to be great suffering. Why? Perception is different. Waking up the wrong side of the bed versus waking up the right side of the bed. The key thing is transform how we see things from a self-referential way to a more open-minded, free way that's in alignment with our intrinsic nature. It may be a lot for tonight to get a hold of. All you have to do is remember the Bodhidharma story. Okay. Show me your mind. You can't find it? Well, I pacified it. I resolved it. Any problem. There was a great Buddhist saint once said that all problems that we feel, if problems can be solved, then it's not a problem. If it can't be solved, it's also not a problem. If you can't solve it, it's not your problem anymore. So what's the problem? No problem. So take the self out of it. Yes.
So what's the difference between the modern Western concept of emotional intelligence and this heart practice? Mm. Why is the heart?
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking only about the mind, if certain parts of the brain control the emotional part of the brain, the logical
mm-hmm.
part can actually train themselves to actually react
mm-hmm.
objectively
mm-hmm.
from the emotion, from the perception, from your sensation.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
Tell me about this emotional intelligence.
Basically, the science that study your brain
mm-hmm.
that will recognize that certain parts of your brain control your emotion, and certain parts of your brain will sort of
mm-hmm.
control your logical side and
mm-hmm.
your factual side, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you learn how to use that logical side to control the emotional side,
mm-hmm.
then you become more free.
Mm. I would say the key difference here, in that definition, is that the realization of heart is not something that can be trained. It can be mimicked. For example, you can use different concepts to tell ourselves, okay, I should be objective, take myself out of it, you know, other people have more of their own perspective, everyone has a story. Kind of. That only works to a certain level. Anything that's kind of mimicked, trained, intellectually processed, only works at a certain level. When you encounter easy life problems, difficulties, you can use that. But when you encounter something that's you're deeply vested in, right? life and death issues, none of that will work. It just goes right out the window. Anything that's conceptual. But the process of practice is not a conceptualized process. Right? It takes two parts. One, you use concept and theory. Another one, you engage in meditation practices. Right? And the meditation practices is something more organic. That when you go through different states, when the mind goes from scatteredness to concentrated, from concentrated to a more unified state, and then eventually to a state of or the realization of no self, that process is a more organic process through which self-referentiality breaks down. So conceptually, I can think of, I shouldn't do this, I should do that. But that process is the same as, I like this, I don't like that. Except now you have a new system, a new set of knowledge that you've acquired from outside yourself that you help you to make decisions, navigate yourself in daily life. Whereas meditation practice breaks down the kind of self-referentially, naturally. Right, naturally. For example, when you sit, and you will know this, when you sit, you have a good period of sitting. You get up. Even when you see garbage on the street, they seem delightful. They kind of jump out at you, brighter even. Right? As opposed to when the mind is kind of scattered, conceptual, or maybe self-referential. Right? Why is that? It's because self naturally dissolves little by little. When there's less chattering here, more concentrated, conversely, out there becomes more apparent. There's a lot of chattering here, you don't even see things that's out there. And why? So the less chattering of mind is the process of concentration. Through concentration, focus developing, self-referentiality naturally diminishes. Until you even move to a state of unified state, where you see outside, inside, are one. So that's, it's more right to the heart, right to the point. So right to the most fundamental core of existential dilemma, human problems. It's not concepts, it's this mechanism, the way we're wired to refer everything to the self. Even in the process of using wisdom, using a set of knowledge to help us, and self-help, even in using that, there's a vested interest of, that would be good for me. And I like. Right? Not good for me. I don't like. See, that mechanism is still there. And it's very hard to use conceptual knowledge to plug that out. You need practice. So, practice and theory. We've gone a little over time. So next time we speak, December, first Monday of December, we have sitting every Monday, usually about 20 some odd people. Those of you who are new, welcome to join. Group practice is always a little easier, better for beginning practitioners. Everyone else is sitting, you're with people of like mind, practice together. So feel free to come. There's a mailing list sheet you can sign up on that small table over there. So As we unpack this sutra, we'll tell you more stories. Stories are always fun. If you don't remember anything else, just remember the stories. And that itself will be able to help us. Okay, thank you. Let's help massage a little bit if you feel sore. Then put the cushions back to that corner over there. Thank you. We're right now changing the place for where we put the cushions. We put it by the door, that corner. Let's see if we fit.